Brandt versus Samuel Son and Company. Mr. Christian? I don't know why it says Brandt on mine. Anyway, where are you, Mr. Christian?
Trustees.
Pardon?
There are two trustees, Brandt and Baldy.
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is John Christian. I represent William A. Brandt, Jr., the Chapter 11 trustee for Longview Aluminum Company. This action arises from three adversary proceedings brought by the trustee pursuant to Sections 544 and Section 548 of the Bankruptcy Code and pursuant to the Illinois Fraudulent Transfer Act to recover fraudulent transfers made to related companies of Longview for services that were not rendered to Longview. These are part of approximately 50 adversary actions involving $20 million. The incident cases involve approximately $3.4 million. Longview was one of the companies that formed part of the so-called financial empire of Michael Lynch, who was a principal in Michigan Avenue Partners, the principals of which owned a number of companies. It acquired Longview when Longview was spun off by Reynolds Aluminum and Alcoa in connection with an EU decision that required divestiture of a portion of the company pursuant to an action brought by McCook, another one of those entities.
It's a good illustration of what an international situation we're in terms of competition control, but that to one side. You place a lot of stress in your brief on the fact that during this period of time, the February 25, 2001 to June 30, 2002 period of time, Longview is under this standstill agreement with Bonneville.
Yes, Your Honor.
Power. And yet, I'm having trouble seeing why that's so significant. You say they didn't produce a single ingot of aluminum, and I understand that, but the company, in a sense, has just found a different way to make money during that period of time, which is to take the $226 million from Bonneville Power, very much like, railroads sometimes couldn't earn too much money running trains, but maybe they sold right-of-way rights to cable companies or something. They're making money. They're paying their bills on time. Why isn't that enough?
Well, in the first instance, Longview was not even able to be purchased. They couldn't obtain financing to purchase the company.
I don't understand. So it was purchased for $140 million.
It was, but they weren't able to obtain financing until the BPA volunteered.
I don't understand on that. Do you think when these people bought the company, they thought it was broke?
I think that when they bought the company, they realized it was at under dire financial circumstances in terms of the cost of electricity and the price of aluminum.
It was obviously a risky operation, but they didn't. You wouldn't buy it if you thought it was broke, would you?
Well, it's not a matter of intent. The question is,
well, I don't know. What are these, idiots or something? They're experienced businessmen. Well, I guess what I find most troublesome about your case is that we have the purchase on February 21st, 2001, and then we have these 50 payments you're trying to get back over a period of, a year and a half or so. I would be interested to know what was the financial condition of the company before each, on the eve of or at the time of each of these expenditures. I mean, the situation deteriorated, but wasn't the first payment in March 2001 that you're trying to recover?
Correct.
Well, that's weeks after the purchase. I think it very improbable that it was broke when it was purchased. Maybe it became broke over the course of the next 15 months or so. But you don't have any evidence of the condition of the company at the various points at which they made the expenditures that you're trying to recover.
Your Honor, this was not an operating company before. It was part of Alcoa.
There was an operating. I don't get that. They pay. These are experienced businessmen. They pay out. I mean, obviously, it comes out of the Bonneville Power, but it's a major transaction. And as Judge Woods said, you know, they had the hope. They have a nice chunk of cash, the $226 million. The hope is that the market will revive and they'll go back into the aluminum business and do well. And I think it's very hard to say that when they made the acquisition, that it was already insolvent.
Well, Your Honor, if you'll bear with me for one moment. In connection with the purchase, they were required to operate for 4 months within the ensuing 22-month period. The first 13 months were curtailed. The only source of income they had was from the BPA, the $226 million.
But I just want to maybe get at this a slightly different way. As I understand your answer from your briefs to the question Judge Posner just asked, you're trying to use this rule of retrojection, which seems like such a funny phrase to me. But anyway, you're trying to show that it was broke on the beginning date, broke on the end date, and therefore and no material changes, and therefore broke all the way through.
And was undercapitalized the entire period of time.
I don't see where the evidence in the record is to show the first of those points, and I think that's where the bankruptcy judge and the district court judge also fell off your argument, is because if it was not, in fact, either undercapitalized or insolvent on the date at the beginning, then you would need to delve into the proof at a much more specific level, which you didn't do, and so you may just have a failure of proof problem.
Well, Your Honor, in order to obtain this company, it was committed to certain obligations, which they would not have to pay only if they reopened. And at no time did they have sufficient funds or financing to reopen at the end of the curtailment period. They were down to approximately $9 million.
On February 21st, 2001, they had various contingent liabilities and risks and so forth, but they didn't know or have reason to know that their liabilities exceeded their assets. This pension, this $47 million, it was all tied up with the other company. You know, obviously they were hoping to avoid it, but it wasn't a certainty.
It doesn't have to be a certainty, Your Honor.
Your expert didn't. Look, every company is loaded with contingent liabilities. Your expert could make any company look broke, right? Because look at General Motors.
I'm sure he wouldn't have done it if there weren't a basis for it, Your Honor. And in this case, there was.
You started talking about contingent liabilities of General Motors for health costs and so on. If General Motors shuts down, as it might, so I say, what companies are solvent if you rate their contingent liabilities at 100%?
Your Honor, this was a company that had no operating funds except that were coming from the.
Are you saying that every new company is insolvent?
They may be undercapitalized if they don't have sufficient working capital.
When a company starts up, it's not operating. Does that mean it's insolvent?
Not necessarily, but in this case, they had to operate.
It might be necessarily. Surely most startups, they may be high risk. They're not insolvent the day they open because they don't have any income.
Your Honor, if I could make a couple of points. In this case, the bankruptcy court made no attempt to value the contingent liabilities at all in this case.
Why didn't your expert do it?
Because you didn't give the bankruptcy court any evidence on that. And I think here we have an important burden of proof point. Your expert comes in and kind of puts a take-it-or-leave-it proposition on the table and says insolvency is 100% likely. Now, of course, the company didn't think insolvency was a 100% likelihood. It wasn't its burden to say, well, we think our insolvency was 60% likely or 30% likely. You should have introduced evidence to show other scenarios. The district judge can't just pull some number out of the air.
Your Honor, the expert, Brooks Myron, whose testimony was unopposed.
I don't think it was unopposed. The district court looks at management projections, looks at their plans, looks at the way they were doing it. That is actually evidence on the other side to show that for a long time they regarded themselves as a going concern.
Your Honor, the bankruptcy court placed great judgment on a great emphasis on what he said was the confidence of management in its projections. But in this, if you look at what was actually said, looking at the record in the trial transcript, volume 1, page 149, talking to Louis Locke, 35-year plant manager, talking about what it would take to restart of $22.5 million. Was that money available to you in the company at that time? No, because the money was not available, and our spreadsheet showed a loss for every month that we operated. Mr. Kalang was asked in page 127 and 128 of his deposition about the pro formas that they had put together. It says, well, depending upon the variables that were used, you know, be it alumina price, energy price, and labor price, depending on what the numbers were plugged in, it either could or couldn't restart. And at that time, we didn't know what April 1st, 2002 would look like.
So how does that satisfy the on-the-deathbed standard that we seem to apply for bankruptcy law?
This entity never operated. If you were operating...
You keep harping on that. You don't understand. Every new company is not operating when it opens. Your proposition is every new company is insolvent because it doesn't operate.
No, that's not my position at all, Your Honor. Our position is that...
Well, you keep saying it wasn't operating as if that were the end of the case.
Well, it's a fact. It didn't operate. It was in curtailment from the beginning.
No, it's the fact you're clinging to as your ship goes down.
Well, let me jump to a different ship then and answer Judge Wood's issue. Rooks Myron, our expert, examined scenarios going forward and determined that in each instance, whether it was a going concern or liquidation scenario, there was no way this company was going to make money. As I mentioned before, it was required.
So he's a better businessman than they are, so he can say that February 21st, 2001, their business plan was so ridiculous that the company was broke?
Well, they had 5 months to operate, or else the whole deal was going to revert to Reynolds.
It was risky.
It was highly risky, and they didn't have sufficient funds to undertake it.
So you're really saying is risky enterprises better not start up, because if they try to start up, no one's going to accept any payment from them because you're going to pull it back.
No,
right?
All I'm saying is that in this case, they entered into a deal taking a chance that perhaps prices would change with respect to the cost of electricity or the price of aluminum.
No, but suppose you're someone who's doing business with Longview, with this new company, and you realize these are experienced people, this is a big operation and so on. And then they find out, they render services, and then they find out that, you know, it's all clawed back.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, what we're talking about is a company that was operating by the skin of its teeth, and we're trying to claw back payments that were made to affiliated companies, not to people who were dealing with Longview, but to affiliates. I see that my time is running into rebuttal time, and I'd like to reserve that.
Thank you, Mr. Christian. Mr. Kerr?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Alexander Kerr on behalf of the defendant, appellees. My colleagues on the brief are here with me. The teed-up appeal creates four issues. First, knowability. That is, were the trustees claimed modifications of additional liabilities to the company's balance sheet factually capable of being known on February 26, 2001?
I'd like to ask you a question, Mr. Kerr, about how one ought to deal with these contingent liabilities. And so as of February 21st, 2001, there was, it seems, a known asset flow, if you will, the $226 million that was supposed to come. And then there were some question marks. So did somebody need to take those contingent liabilities and discount them in some fashion and say, well, the chances are 30% that we're going to have to cover the McCook retiree funds or some other percentage before you figured out that it was a going concern, or is or are those contingent liabilities irrelevant if you think the company's a going concern?
As we read Zonix, Covey, and Taxman, it is a fact question as to what was known on the valuation date at bar. And so if there is a sufficient level of knowledge by management, reasonable knowledge by management, that there are real contingencies that an auditor or an accountant would identify to a balance sheet standard, then it would have to be discounted, calculated, or noted. We do not have those facts in this case.
Now, who would have had the burden of introducing such information in the case if we imagine that it might be out there?
Well, Taxman gives us some instruction, where in Taxman it was within the 90 days, and under Section 547F, the trustee has the benefit of a presumption of insolvency. Here we are over 2 years, and we're paying our bills when due as due. The first date selected, as noted, we get a $226 million contract. We pay out, we get a $167 million bridge loan so that we have immediate cash. We pay out $140 million to buy the company from the Reynolds Alcoa Group. That leaves us, on the date of closing, between the bridge loan and the payout, $27 million of working capital on day one. Then if you take the $226 and you run it out for the period of time and the bridge loan of $167 million is paid up, you get an additional $59 million that is, at that point, up to management to determine how they're going to use.
Now, wasn't some of that committed to the union, to paying the workers and the like?
Exactly, and that is why the curtailment is not a closure. They kept the labor force in place. They kept workers coming into this plant to work on every pot in every pot line to have this company ready and willing to go.
And the pot line?
That is where the alumina powder is put into a large pot and electricity and other items are added in order to make the liquid aluminum from which ingots are extruded.
Thank you.
Does that mean that it's partly your position that had there been a hypothetical restart of this company, that it wouldn't have been so expensive? I mean, that you were essentially ready to turn the switch and start operating? Or?
Well, there still would be a ramp up, and that was part of the financials, which the 5-year financials, which are in the record, that identify exactly why this was a path ultimately to profitability on the assumptions and information available to management on February 26, 2001. It is in the record and unrebutted that McCook, under the same principles, had a business plan, and the GE witness, Mr. McKay, testified that they had met and exceeded the $20 million in profit under the business plan that they had in McCook, and GE was pleased with that kind of result. So we are not dealing with people in a startup who had no knowledge of the industry or no understanding what was going on.
The pension thing, how is that treated on your balance sheet? Was that in a footnote or what?
No, Your Honor. On February 26, 2001, all the affiliated companies were current in all of their payments to the PBGC. There was, at that juncture, and the record is devoid of any evidence that would suggest that Longview had knowledge or a factual basis to believe that there was risk coming to them from any affiliates. And
this contingent liability is from the affiliates. Pension obligation?
The initial amount is, yes, correct, Your Honor. And in both Covey and in Zonix, where there are multiple affiliated companies, as there were here, and by the way, in the PBGC materials of record, we identify 9 affiliates. The expert makes no attempt to identify the value, cash flow, contribution, exposures of all nine. He takes those where he can find some liability and focuses solely on Longview without bringing any focus to any of the other companies. Zonix and Covey both had, this court made a significant effort to identify what the relationship was and what the interaction and interchange was among all the affiliated companies. As the district court noted below, and speaking of this PBGC liability, this district court said it was never established in its de novo review of the record whether Longview had pension liability in February 2001. If so, how much of it would then exist? If so, how much is attributed to Longview itself as compared to any of the other affiliates? What kind of negotiations, contributions, partial payments could otherwise be expected or involved? And there was simply a failure of proof on that point.
What is the situation today? Does the Longview plant still exist?
It does not. After a Chapter 11 filing in March of 2003, some 2 years after this first valuation date, and after a conversion from Chapter 11 to Chapter 7 and the commencement of dismantling of the plant, once it was starting to be dismantled, then you no longer had the prospect of turning it back on. But during the initial period of the Chapter 11, there was the potential to sell the plant to somebody else.
I was just curious. So the plant has disappeared. So.
That is correct, Your Honor.
There's no more aluminum industry in the Northwest.
Well, there's no more at this site.
This site. But there is still an aluminum industry in the Northwest.
Aluminum companies.
Okay. I'm just curious.
Mr. Kerr, would you want to comment on this Friedland case that Mr. Christian provided recently?
Well, the Friedland case is consistent with Covey, and indeed we would submit that the bankruptcy court went to pains to comply with the standards that Friedland announced, even though he didn't have the benefit of it. It requires that there be a factual basis and a rendition by the trial court as to what are the factual components upon which the court relies in making its decision. In Covey, one of the largest potential obligations in debate was a $24 million bond claim. That bond claim was trying to be evaluated some 10 months before the filing of the bankruptcy petition. It was determined on the facts that had been rendered in that case that that claim was unknowable as of the valuation date. So if there are insufficient facts presented in a record, a judge cannot be expected to either become an advocate and start trying to find facts, or have to create out of whole air facts which the parties did not present to him.
Well, that's why I was asking you before. I think if I understood your answer, you were saying that there has to be some degree, some fairly concrete degree of knowledge about a contingent liability to begin with before you can start talking about a discount factor for it. But I think the trustee's position is that anyone but an ostrich should have known that there were some pretty significant contingent liabilities here, and thus evidence should have come in about those discount factors.
If one looks at a bankrupt company after it has filed bankruptcy and starts looking backward, they can always try to create some thread in order to drive insolvency as far back as they want. We didn't select the first valuation date. The first valuation date is the way the case was framed that was brought against our clients.
Right, as we've said, yeah.
On that date, there was positive cash flow, as I have summarized.
Sure.
There was a five-year plan to profitability. There was no evidence. You can search the record, and you will not find any evidence where either the expert or the trustee, through other witnesses, attempted to anchor these claims of liability as having factual knowledge and basis on February 26, 2001, which is the legal standard. But the rest of it becomes the factual issue. And to that point, I might for a moment jump to the sole expert role in this case and a sort of demand that you must accept an expert's view. This court in the Clark case, cited by the trustee, helps, I think, focus even beyond what the district court said, which was not responded to in the reply briefs. In Clark, there was a well-credentialed expert who was accepted. He wrote a report, and that is a parallel to what happens here. In Clark, summary judgment was issued on behalf of the defendant in a products liability case because the expert had failed to follow the standards that would be applicable in that case for measurement and testing and the like. In this case, the expert, for whatever reason, either didn't have the information, couldn't get the information, but failed to follow the standard of anchoring each of the claims of liability to a knowledge basis, a fact basis on the valuation date which the trustee had selected. There was demonstrable, in our view, bias here. And the bias is most shown by the aluminum contract claims, where the expert steadfastly and stubbornly remains at 100% liability, absolute sureness that this is going to come to visit some 18 months down the road and is going to have no positive value, but is going to have negative value to the debtor. The trustee in this case.
These are the take-or-pay contracts you're talking about?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the trustee in this case had testified that he viewed that contract, because of the changes in alumina pricing and market conditions, to be a potential $20 to $30 million asset of the company, if he could have assumed it and assigned it. So that even the trustee in the case has presented information which the expert refuses to consider and steadfastly stays fixated on an 0% chance of this company.
Was it rising electricity prices that doomed the enterprise, or were there other factors?
It was a factor in the process, but it was not the sole factor by any means which would have doomed it. The problem with the Bonneville Power Authority take-or-pay provision is the trustee, the expert, refused and admitted.
I'm not asking about that. In fact, of course, Longview failed and was dismantled. So my question is, what was the critical factor that did it in? Was it rising electricity prices, or falling market for aluminum, or falling or what?
I think they got caught with this is not clear in the record, Judge, but I believe that they got caught by a confluence of all those factors. The business plan model and the financing documents showed that they were trying to go into the high-grade aluminum, and this was a high-grade aluminum plant, into the aerospace industry. As we know, and they had targeted Airbus and Boeing. Well, after this, Boeing moves to Chicago. We all can read in the papers where Boeing's Air Force tanker contract has extended out. So there were forces going on in the industry for them. There was electricity cost, there was alumina cost, but we just don't know that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Kerr. Mr. Christian, how much time does he have? 2 minutes? Yeah. Go ahead.
Your Honor, there are so many things. He talks about knowability. The touchstone is what would a willing buyer pay for the bundle of assets and liabilities. And Mr. Myron examined all the circumstances, including historical pricing, and concluded that no one would pay anything for this company because it could not operate at a profit. going in, aluminum prices were low, electricity prices were extraordinarily historically high.
Why did he think they bought it then? I mean, just for the fun of going through bankruptcy?
Well, I think that maybe they thought that things could improve because, as I mentioned when I read the quotes from the other people, at least from John Kalang, they didn't know where things would be in 2002. They may have hoped. In fact, their projections, their five-year projections, included an assumption that electricity would continue to be priced at $29.50 a megakilowatt hour, and as of the date they bought it, as the month before, the price was already $30.55 a kilowatt hour.
They were talking about building a new generator plant, too, though, weren't they?
Yeah, that never happened. The company never attempted to reopen. Michigan Avenue Partners didn't have capital that didn't do it. By August of 2001, both McCook and Scottsboro had filed for bankruptcy. The evidence that Myron relied on showed that McCook was insolvent, according to an expert report rendered by Scott Peltz, as of December 31, 2000, even before this transaction occurred, which is why the money started to be filtered out anyway. He talks about the working capital on day one. The projections show that at the end of the curtailment period, there would be approximately $10 million. The offering circular by Credit Suisse First Boston indicated that in the range of $50 million of working capital would be required. The minimum number that we've seen is $20 to $25 million. The question is asked, what was known on February 26, 2001? It was known that if the plant did not open after curtailment, they would have a liability of $50 million to the steelworkers. There would be a take-or-pay obligation of $20.6 million, which is compared to an actual claim of $62 million, and a payment, a forfeiture penalty of $6 million on the alumina contract. What Mr. Kerr was referring to in terms of what the trustee thought was an asset, what referred to the alumina contract, but too late, after the time period was up. As I said, they had to open within a five-month period. They couldn't do it. They realized when they began this venture that they could only succeed if they were able to operate and open within that five-month period. They didn't do it. They didn't have the financing available, and the only record evidence in this case...
5 months after the curtailment period. Right?
Correct,
yeah.
Because they had to operate for 4 months during the 22-month period, or the whole deal would revert to Alcoa Reynolds. The only unrebutted evidence in this case about value is Brooks Myron. Why should he cop a plea and say, oh, I think it's 80%, if he believed from his numbers that there was no basis for operating profitably? He looked at what it would take in order to operate profitably and said, with respect to the first valuation date, only one time in the prior 10-year period had aluminum ever touched that level. And the second valuation date, he said, not once in the 12-year prior period had it. There's no way they could make money. There's no way they could succeed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Christian.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Next case.